It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. We are your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where we have fair skies, 50 degrees, east winds to 9 miles per hour at the airport right now, where they have 80% humidity and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for partly sunny skies for the rest of the day with a high near 54, southeast winds to 5. Mostly cloudy for tonight and tomorrow with an overnight low of 42, though southeast winds are expected to continue, come up to maybe 15 tomorrow. It does look like rain starting Sunday and going into next week. Coming up on the Midday Report, two Kodiak museums will be collaborating to catalog artifacts that have never before been seen by the public. Governor Mike Dunleavy hosted a conference on Alaska's energy future that featured both fossil fuel production and renewables like wind and solar. And Unalaska's local tribe is working to stop the spread of avian influenza.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden is expected to address the nation tonight about just how close it came to defaulting on its financial obligations, which would have had global repercussions. That outcome's been averted, though, with Congress's approval of a bipartisan bill that lifts the debt ceiling. The White House says the president is expected to sign the legislation as soon as tomorrow. Here's NPR's Franco Ordonez.
President Biden has another win to notch after the Senate followed the House and passed legislation that cuts federal spending as well as suspends the debt ceiling until after the 2024 election. The bipartisan deal comes just days before the Treasury Secretary had warned that the government would run out of money to pay its bills. It also ends months of tensions in Washington after Republicans refused to raise the debt limit unless Biden and the Democrats place more restrictions on federal spending. The president tweeted after the Senate vote that no one gets everything they want in a negotiation, but that senators voted to protect hard-earned economic progress. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
One of the three major rating agencies says the United States' AAA credit rating is still at risk despite the latest debt limit deal. NPR's David Gura reports Fitch Ratings says it's still concerned about rising deficits and political polarization.
Once again, the U.S. government has managed to avoid a default, but Fitch Ratings says it plans to, quote, consider the full implications of the most current brinksmanship episode in the months to come. In May, the agency warned the U.S. it was reevaluating its long-held AAA rating. Fitch says political standoffs around the debt limit affect confidence in the U.S., and it plans to assess the coherence and credibility of policymaking. It also plans to look closely at the trajectory of U.S. debt. After the announcement, yields on U.S. government bonds edged higher. David Gura, NPR News, New York.
The Labor Department reports the U.S. economy gained 339,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate rose to 3.7%. Washington's prepared to talk to Moscow without conditions about a nuclear arms control framework after Russia decided to suspend its involvement in the last remaining nuclear arms treaty it had with the U.S. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan delivered a speech today at the Arms Control Association's annual meeting. He said the country stands at an inflection point in the U.S.'s nuclear stability and security that demands new strategies to reduce the risk of nuclear conflict.
Earlier this year, President Putin unlawfully suspended Russia's implementation of the New START treaty that places limits on the most destructive weapons in our arsenals, the kinds that could destroy the world many times over. Only a month later, President Putin began to take steps to station tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus.
Russia made the move as tensions increased following its invasion of Ukraine last year. It's NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Two Kodiak museums will be collaborating to catalog over 1,000 artifacts never before seen by the public. The Kodiak History Museum and the Aleutic Museum announced the joint project. And as KMXT's Brian Venois reports, it's the biggest unprocessed collection the History Museum has.
All 1,100 pieces being processed were found around the archipelago in the mid-20th century. Altogether, the stone and bone objects and tools fill about a dozen file boxes. Margaret Greidart is the chief curator for the Kodiak History Museum. She says they're partnering with the Aleutic Museum because they'll need extra hands to process such a huge collection.
We are a small historical society, and this is kind of the first time that we've been able to process a huge collection like this. And so that partnership with the Aleutic Museum is really important in sharing that knowledge. And it also makes sure that both of our collections are comparable to each other.
The artifacts have been waiting a long time to be processed. Greidart says she was excited to receive a grant from Museums Alaska's Collections Management Fund and finally process the finds. The funding allows them to contract the archaeology staff at the Aleutic Museum to help catalog each item.
A lot of them just look like rocks. They're actually not. Most of them are stone tools. And so that's part of what the Aleutic Museum is going to help us with, is identifying what tools these are, what materials these are, and then rehousing them in a way where you can see everything and you can access everything.
Amanda Lancaster is the curator of collections at the Aleutic Museum. She says the two museums make for an excellent partnership.
I think for a smaller museum, that could be a much bigger project, but because we have the staff capacity and we have that sort of built-in expertise, it can go a little smoother for us, I think, just because we have that. And so, they got the funding and we brought the expertise.
It's a big job. Aleutic Museum staff will wash and dust off each piece and use archival paper and ink to catalog every item or batch of items.
Margaret and I are going to sort of come up with a catalog sheet that gets all the information they need while providing all the context we think is important.
Some of that information includes tool types, field notes, and how deep it was when it was found, and notes about artifact condition. Altogether, about 5 people will be working on the project. They expect to process about 10 objects an hour, depending on how detailed their notes will be. The joint project is slated to have the entire collection processed by the end of the year. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
Last week, Governor Mike Dunleavy hosted a 3-day conference focused on Alaska's energy future. The conference highlighted the state's efforts to increase fossil fuel production and to boost renewables like wind and solar. Climate advocates say that's a big contradiction, but Alaska officials disagree. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
Renewable energy and fossil fuels. It often seems like we need to choose one or the other. But last week, Alaska officials made the case that the state needs both.
Alaska is known and will continue to be known as an oil and gas giant.
That's Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy welcoming attendees from around the world to a sustainable energy conference in Anchorage. Alaska is an oil and gas state, he says, but it can no longer only be an oil and gas state.
So when we talk about energy for Alaska, it is going to be all in. It is going to be oil. It is going to be gas. It's going to be wind. It's going to be solar. It's going to be geothermal. It's going to be biomass. It's going to be nukes.
In an interview, Dunleavy broke down his administration's energy outlook. Selling oil and gas has long been a major revenue source for the state, supporting everything from schools to roads. But Alaskans have also always struggled with the high cost of energy at home. Dunleavy says Alaska should double down on exporting fossil fuels outside to bring money in, while at the same time building more renewable energy in-state to lower bills at home.
We want to be a player on the world stage in oil and gas, as well as coal, as well as biomass. Internally, we have to lower the cost of energy and make it stable. And that's where you see a lot of the renewable concepts come into play.
The cost to operate renewable energy projects has dropped dramatically in recent years. Meanwhile, rural communities in Alaska face some of the highest energy costs in the nation, often relying on expensive imported diesel and heating oil. Dunleavy says for him, investing in renewables is not about lowering carbon emissions or combating climate change. It's just about securing cheap energy for Alaskans that's not tied to the volatile price of oil.
From my perspective, if a diesel generator could be producing electricity at a very low cost consistently, we would consider that as well.
Historically, Alaskans have not pursued renewable energy because of climate benefits.
That's Philip White, an energy historian at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
We have pursued renewable energy because it has reduced our reliance on diesel and other higher cost fossil fuels. We've done it for economic reasons, not climate reasons.
White says this has been Alaska's approach for decades. Export fossil fuels for revenue and find the cheapest sources to use at home. But he says as climate change accelerates, this model no longer works. Alaska is facing the growing impacts of climate change, from sea ice loss and thawing permafrost to species die-offs. White argues that as long as Alaska continues to pull billions of barrels of oil out of the ground, the state is contributing to its own environmental problems.
Even if we get cheaper priced domestic energy here in Alaska, we're still exacerbating a global problem, and a global problem where, you know, Alaska is warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. We're not escaping that problem. We're on the front lines of the climate crisis.
Proponents of fossil fuel production point out that there's no clear alternative revenue source if the state ended oil production. But experts like White predict that as the world transitions away from fossil fuels, eventually Alaska will have to stop drilling. Meanwhile, clean energy advocates like Rachel Christensen with the Alaska Center say the state still isn't doing enough to invest in renewables, and they'd like to see the governor do more.
What we're seeing is just talk about the potential of solutions. We need to see him actually taking action on putting those into place.
She points to two proposals that were taken up in the legislature this year. One would require utilities to source a certain amount of their energy from renewable sources, and another would help finance renewable projects in small communities. Dunleavy said he supported both, but neither passed. Christensen would also like to see the administration take climate change more seriously in its energy policy.
It should be more than just an economic move. Our people and industries are already feeling the effects of the climate crisis, and we can't keep pushing these large-scale extraction projects for export just because it's what we've always done.
Christensen says in an era of climate change and shifting global energy markets, what we've always done won't always work. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
An Alaska's local tribe is working to stop the spread of a concerning strain of avian flu that could be killing birds in the Aleutian region. KUCB's Sophia Stewart-Rossi reports the tribe's biggest concern is the virus making the leap from animals to humans.
Last spring, cases of the highly contagious H5N1 strain were detected in migratory birds coming to Alaska. And in January, the state's Department of Environmental Conservation reported that two bald eagles and a gull in Unalaska were found dead with the virus. Mandy Salminen is the environmental director for the Cowlungan tribe, which recently launched an effort to slow H5N1 spread on the island. She says the virus can be passed on to other wildlife, like foxes, marine mammals, and even to humans.
If we can try to stop the bird-to-human part of it, or at least slow it down or reduce it by a lot, then that mutation from human to human, it doesn't have as much of an opportunity. Because really what it is us giving the virus an opportunity to adapt and make those jumps.
According to Salminen, there are cases around the world of humans getting sick and dying from the strain, but there aren't any cases where the virus transferred from human to human. Still, she says the bird flu evolves over time.
So that's really our big concern. While the birds and the other species are important, human health is at the end that we're concerned about.
Even if the virus doesn't lead to death and people just get sick, Salminen says healthcare is sparse in rural areas like Unalaska, which doesn't have a hospital. If many people get sick at once, that could overwhelm the island system. In Alaska, the first case of H5N1 was found last spring in chickens in the Matsu Borough. Then it was detected in Unalaska when a red fox and eagles were found dead with the disease. Wildlife officials said the animals were most likely feeding on birds that had died from H5N1 flu. Salminen says the virus is affecting populations of other birds, like seabirds and ducks, that many Alaskans depend on for subsistence. She says population decline among some species could be detrimental.
The big thing for, like, rural and remote Alaska is food security. So if you're hunting for these birds or collecting eggs from these birds, if there's a big die-off, that means that there's not as strong of food securities.
Recently, local residents have observed a decrease in the island's raven population. But Salminen says there just isn't enough local data collection to determine if that drop is related to the avian flu.
I wouldn't be surprised. Ravens, crows, gulls, eagles, they're all big scavengers. So if they see a dead bird, they might eat off of it. And that might cause them to pick up the virus and die. But without actually being able to test, we can't say for certain that that's what caused it.
Salminen talked to Unalaskans about the disease at a presentation in early May. She says spreading awareness about avian flu is a big part of preventing its spread.
So this is going to provide a structure, like, yes, it's going to be geared towards avian flu. However, we can apply a lot of the same partnerships even and, you know, roles to the other wildlife health diseases. So that's the goal.
The Cowanlungan tribe's multi-year plan to slow down the virus, an effort funded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is part of a bigger picture, says Salminen. The tribe is working with stakeholders and other local leaders to create strategies for future wildlife health crises. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
Further details were released Thursday evening about the 2017 killing of Eric Garcia, a prominent Ketchikan surgeon. The surgeon's romantic partner was convicted of the murder on Thursday in Anchorage. And as KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, the new information pieces together a timeline of what happened.
58-year-old Eric Garcia had been in a romantic relationship with his convicted killer, Jordan Joplin, for 6 years. On March 15th of 2017, Joplin came to Ketchikan from his Washington home for what he called a visit. But new information from the state's Department of Law says he also made arrangements for 3 large shipping containers to be sent to Garcia's address. He scheduled the containers to arrive 2 days after he got there. And then, when they were delivered, he loaded the containers with more than 4,000 pounds of Garcia's expensive personal collections. Garcia was known to have a large array of coins, watches, jewelry, and pricey liquor worth thousands of dollars. Ketchikan police say that much of it was missing from Garcia's house in the days after his death. The statement says Joplin had sent the items to his own address back in Washington. Police would also find Garcia's phone and wallet in Joplin's home. Police also tracked electronic bank transfers from the surgeon's accounts to Joplin, totaling more than $30,000. New details also emerged about the day that Joplin called Ketchikan police asking for a welfare check on Garcia. That was 10 days after Joplin had left town. He told officers that Garcia was due to visit him in Washington, but he hadn't heard from him. Joplin traveled back to Ketchikan, where he drove Garcia's own truck to the surgeon's house to let police in with keys he had. The home's alarm system was found to be off. While searching Joplin's cell phone, police found a video of Garcia unconscious in the same position and clothes that he was in when he was found dead. A toxicology screening confirmed Garcia died of a morphine overdose. He also had lorazepam, diazepam, and methadone in his system. The trial took most of May. It had been postponed several times and moved from Ketchikan to Juneau and finally to Anchorage due to the amount of publicity it received in Ketchikan. Joplin was convicted of first and second degree murder and first degree theft. According to the Department of Law, Joplin is facing a sentence between 30 and 101 years. He's scheduled to be sentenced in early October. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
For the second year in a row, cool, rainy spring weather has delayed planting of some crops at Delta Junction area farms. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Delta area farmers had about 2 weeks of good planting weather last month before cool temperatures and rain set in this past weekend. UAF Cooperative Extension Service agent Phil Kaspari says that was just enough time for most of them to plant crops for livestock feed.
We're 3/4 done with the small grain planting and barley, wheat, oats, some field peas, and a little bit of canola.
Kaspari says those who weren't able to get those plants in the ground may have to wait until the weather system that's brought frost to some areas passes through.
For the folks that are still trying to get barley planted, yeah, this is going to be a setback. Normally, we like to be going by the 10th of May.
Cool weather was a big problem last year when farmers had to wait even longer to plant. That and the short growing season and other problems sent the price of livestock feed soaring. So after another late breakup this year, farmers hustled to prevent that from happening again. Many planted hay this year, which Kaspari says will do just fine with all that rainfall.
The folks that are doing hay acreage, which is the bulk of our acreage here in the Delta area, this is a real blessing.
But it'll be a mixed blessing for all the area's farmers because the precipitation also will bring a bumper crop of weeds.
The weeds are going to love this, so people have to be prepared to deal with weed management.
This rain's kind of making that tough for me. I'm a little behind on my spraying now.
Scott Mugridge is a Delta farmer and rancher and president of the Alaska Farm Bureau. Mugridge says he's held off spraying weed killer because it's not as effective when applied during rainy spells. He says he's also behind schedule applying fertilizer to his fields.
We just don't like to fertilize in the rain. It's hard on equipment, and so we've been holding off on that.
But Alaska's growing season is short and time's a-wastin', so Mugridge says he and his crew began fertilizing Wednesday, despite the mud and rain.
We've waited long enough. We got to go. You know, it's hard to sit by and watch time pass when you know you've got things to do.
The Cooperative Extension's Kaspari says time is always on the mind of farmers, and the last 2 years have made it clear that they can't count on a late fall to make up for a late spring.
It just seems like our Augusts have been extra drizzly and wet, and then it drags the harvest season well into September.
Farmers hope that won't happen again this year. Kaspari says they'd like to finish baling hay and straw before September. And if they're still out in the fields that month, he hopes it's because farmers are harvesting a second cutting of those crops. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
The labor market continues to surprise. I'm Novosafo with the Marketplace Minute. U.S. employers added 340,000 jobs last month. Analysts were expecting fewer than 200,000. Strong hiring comes on the heels of an unexpected spike in job openings. The unemployment rate, which is measured by a separate survey, rose slightly to 3.7%, still low. Meanwhile, wage growth moderated a bit last month, up 0.3% compared to April. If wage growth is slowing, that could also slow inflation and maybe encourage the Federal Reserve to pause interest rate hikes. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is warning Americans not to park their money in payment apps such as Venmo and PayPal. That's because in most cases, those app accounts are not insured the way bank accounts are. I'm Novosafo with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the second day of June, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 5:17. It will set again at 10:59. That will give us 17 hours and 42 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 2 minutes and 37 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for the state was 67 degrees set in 1984, and a record low was 33 set in 1968. Currently, 50 degrees under fair skies. It's a beautiful day. They're calling for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Southeast winds continuing through tomorrow, maybe come up to 15 tomorrow. Starting on Sunday, though, rain is likely, and that rain is expected to continue through Thursday, at least, they're saying. Looking at our local tides, we have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will be at 2:05 this afternoon and be 6.5 feet. That will be followed by a low tide at 7:13 p.m. of 2.2 feet. Over on the west side, your next high tide will happen at 2:28 this afternoon and be a 12-foot tide in Larson Bay, followed by a low tide at 8:03 of 3 feet. We do have significant minus tides tomorrow morning for you tide poolers. There will be a low tide here on the east side at 8:21 tomorrow morning. That will be a minus 1.5 foot tide. And a low tide over on the west side at 8:51 tomorrow morning. That will be minus 2.7 feet in Larsen Bay. Mariners, here's your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. South winds to 15 knots for today and tonight. Seas to 3 feet, building to 4 feet tonight. And for tomorrow, southeast 15, seas to 4 feet. Coming up to southeast 20 Saturday night with 6-foot seas. Over in the Shelikof Strait, southwest 15 today, seas to 3 feet. Southeast 15 tonight, seas to 3 feet. And east 20 tomorrow, seas to 3 feet, building to 5 feet tomorrow night. The following are upcoming Kodiak Island Borough public meetings. On Tuesday, June 6th, the Women's Bay Service Area Board will be having its regular meeting in the Women's Bay Fire Hall at 5:30 p.m. And on Thursday, June 8th, the Assembly will be having a special meeting followed by a work session in the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. These meetings are open to the public and meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk with any questions at 907-486-9310. Our voices have power. We use our voices to share stories, express ourselves, and to spark change. This summer, Find Your Voice is the theme of the Kodiak Public Library's Summer Reading Challenge. From June 1st to September 1st, you log the minutes you read, write book reviews, and participate in activities to complete the challenge. Saturdays, tomorrow at 10:15, the library hive check is going on. Kids under 5 must watch from inside, and kids under 13 should be supervised by a parent or guardian. Previous attendees have already signed up, hopefully. Sign up at the library at 907-486-8686. Library hours are Mondays, Fridays, and Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and Tuesdays and Thursdays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. The Kodiak Public Library Association Board of Directors will be meeting next Tuesday in the Public Library's multipurpose room at 5:30 p.m. The public is welcome to attend, and the agenda will be posted on their website. That's at kpla.us. Attention, Kodiak High School class of 1973. They're having a reunion dinner September 2nd. For more information, go to their website at myevent.com/Kodiak73. Or you can call Janelle at 425-879-7067 or Terry at 907-654-7713.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the June 2nd edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Wasn't Thursday a lovely day? Made me think of barbecues, fires on the beach, fishing, and more. A few more days of at least partial sun, and some of the things that are a little slow to green up this year will catch up. In the meantime, I heard my first golden crown sparrow yesterday. That sweet song just makes me think of summer. If you like to forage for food, this is a good time to be out there. Many of the fiddleheads are past their prime already, but you might still find some good ones. In the meantime, there are beach greens, fireweed shoots, and more out there if you want to add some variety to your vegetable selection this time of year. In the next couple of weeks, we'll likely see a burst of color in the fields and along the cliffs. Right now, there are lots of yellow things, dandelions, buttercups, and sequoia blossoms. Scattered among them are the magenta-colored shooting stars and delicate white rock cress. I found a stray marsh violet the other day, too. Lupin plants are growing, although I haven't seen any blossoms yet, but it won't be long and everything will pop. I have faith. The big bumblebees are out and about, making the most of the dandelions and other types of flowers for much-needed food. Another type of bee, the honeybees, are back at the hives at the Kodiak Public Library. You can learn more about the bees and get a closer look during the hive checks on Saturdays at 10:30 a.m. Call the library at 907-486-8686 to sign up for your spot to watch the hive check on a Saturday. Whatever your plans this week, I hope you get out to enjoy some fresh, hopefully warmer, air. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.